You're listening to Cutaneous Miscellaneous, the Dermatology Residents Podcast.
So on this episode, we've got the man, the myth, and the legend. And he's actually not a myth. He's a real person. He's a legend, and he's the man. It's great to welcome Dr. Charlie Dunn. So, Charlie, what's going on?
Dr. Brownstone, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me. I can't tell you how excited I am to be part of this incredible podcast that you've put together. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for the kind words. And when I emailed you about getting together for this, I know we're both very busy. We're doing a lot in dermatology, which is great. And I said, Charlie, are you flexible with recording times? And you said, I just started doing yoga, so I'm very flexible. And I said, this is my guy here. We're going to have a great episode. So
that's right.
I'm so happy to have you on.
I'm actually in Warrior II pose right now, and I'm going to maintain Warrior II the entire episode.
That's a first for Cutaneous Miscellaneous.
There you go.
You've heard it here first, folks. So I may have to do a little downward dog while we're doing the episode.
Yes,
if you hear me panting heavily, I'm doing yoga. So I hope everything comes through clearly. So this might be a first for all of us. No, we'll save the yoga for another time. All right. Let's get to the episode.
Good deal.
Charlie Dunn, board certified pediatrician, chief dermatology resident. So we're going to talk about some really great things. Board review and what is Camp Discovery? Discovering Camp Discovery, we can learn more about the history, what goes on there, how we can all get involved, and ultimately how it helps our patients every day. The most important
thing. Big episode today.
Yep, huge episode. One of the best we're going to have. One of the best we've had for sure. No doubt about that. So,
you
Charlie, let's start with
epidermolysis. Yeah. Epidermolysis bullosa.
Let's start with epidermolysis bullosa. So, this is a group of heterogeneously inherited mechanical bullous disorders that are manifested as fragile skin leading to blisters. So we have EB simplex, intraepidermal blister, junctional EB, which is lamina lucida, dystrophic EB, lamina densa, and Kindler syndrome, kind of a newer entity that's kind of a mixed plane blister that was recently described. And Charlie, before we jump in, I just want to do a quick minute or two on transport media. Super high yield for the derm path core and for the boards itself.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Yep. So routine biopsies, yep, these go in obviously 10% buffered formalin, but you need about 1 to 2 hours per millimeter of thickness. So a 3 millimeter specimen should cook for 3 hours. That could come up. I bring this up because if you induce a blister for diagnosing epidermolysis bullosa, it has to go in glutaraldehyde for the electron microscopy. And finally, we have immunofluorescence. We need Michel's media, also known as Zeus media. This is ammonium sulfate. A normal saline can work well. Additionally, and I have a quick funny story. My first day of residency, patient came in with generalized bullae. He actually was on nivolumab and had a BP-induced dermatosis from nivolumab. My attending said, okay, we're going to have to biopsy this. Let's get Michel. And I said, who's Michelle? Is that our admin? She ran out of the room and said, our chief resident was Jen at the time. She goes, Jen, somebody help this guy. He's got no idea what's going on. So, so that can be confusing for a first day of residence. So I wanted
Absolutely.
To go through that. So Charlie, let's start with EB simplex. Level of the split is interdermal. It's the most common form. It's an AD inheritance, except for obviously EBS with muscular dystrophy. That's going to be plectin. And they generally hear about heal without scarring. So the first one is EBS localized, also called Weber Cockayne. Can you tell me a little bit about this and what's important for the boards?
Yeah, absolutely. I think just to also back up, I think the reason that epidermolysis bullosa has showed up literally on every core that I've taken is because it's intrinsically related to the basement membrane zone. And I think whenever I studied epidermolysis bullosa, it's always in the context of understanding and knowing in detail really the basement membrane zone. I think that's a key component to this. So whenever you're studying and thinking about epidermolysis bullosa, you need to have that in mind. And I think that that'll really kind of help you. So in terms of EBS, localized, or really was previously called Weber Cockayne, autosomal dominant in epidermolysis bullosa simplex in general, this split is going to be at the basal layer of the keratinocytes just above the hemidesmosome, and it's caused by a break in keratin 5 and 14. So those are the genes that are involved, keratin 5 and 14. And this can be a really subtle clinical presentation. It presents really with these blisters or tense bullae on the hands and feet, so really on the soles and palms. And that can be the only clinical manifestations. I diagnosed this actually once as a pediatrician In Alaska, and it was this patient that came in that had these recurrent blisters on their feet, and I'm like, well, you got to get better shoes, and they got better shoes, and then they kept getting blisters on the feet, and I'm like, well, you got to talk to your dad because your dad didn't get you the right shoes, and dad's like, no, this has always happened to me, and I'm like, wait, what? And dad's like, oh yeah, it's happened to you know, like all of my parents and all of their parents, and I'm like, wait a second, something's a little bit fishy here, and so EBS localized is just that's kind of a story to kind of hopefully create a memory kind of key for you that it can present just as tensible on the hands and feet, usually worse with heat and ill-fitting shoes, frictional trauma from walking, and they have normal lifespan. They otherwise look normal. So that's what I think about with EBS localized. And then it just kind of gets progressively more severe in terms of EBS generalized intermediate and EBS generalized severe. Both of those are related to keratin 5 and 14 mutations, but basically it takes less friction to make more problems. So in generalized intermediate, tensepullae happen not just in areas of super high friction like your feet, but they happen at any site of friction like your elbows, like your knees, like your head, shoulders, knees, and toes. People with intermediate, they tend to have kind of normal lifespans. But I think in general, you don't need to really know the difference between intermediate and severe. In clinical practice, you might see it. In severe, you get generalized blisters everywhere. And it can be a little tricky because they can be herpetiform. They can almost look clustered. So if you see this on a Kodachrome in a test, you might say, oh, that's disseminated herpes. But one unique feature of this is they are not inflammatory blisters or inflammatory bulla. They're not on an erythematous base. These are mechanobullous, meaning that they are caused by friction. So there's not inflammation at the base. And people with EBS generalized severe, they tend to have nail dystrophy. They get palmoplantar hyperkeratosis. And while we don't really do it anymore, I did see a test question once where they asked about the electron microscopy of a patient with blistering, and it showed clumped tonofilaments, and that is EBS. And unfortunately, these people can have a limited lifespan, and the main cause of death in patients with this is actually sepsis. So those are kind of the main EBS subtypes. I think, Nick, you have a great perspective on EBS with muscular dystrophy, which is unique in this situation. It's autosomal recessive. Why don't you tell me a little bit about that?
Awesome. Charlie, that was really great review. I love the stories. Stories is how we remember things in dermatology, because we have to remember so many things. It's good to put a story to it. So, of course, EBS of muscular dystrophy, this is autosomal recessive, and it's not keratin 5 and 14. The gene is PLEC, and the protein is PLECTIN that's mutated. And it's pretty straightforward in that patients get EBS, they get bullae, they get blisters, but they have muscle weakness. Now, the muscle weakness is delayed. It may develop in infancy through childhood. And the biggest morbidity comes from this muscular dystrophy. So if you see a test question that deals with blisters and muscular dystrophy, they might ask about if it's autosomal recessive. They may ask about plectin. That should clue you in. One more thing to finish this out, EBS at model pigmentation. This is also autosomal dominant, keratin 5 and 14, like the other EBS that we discussed. And they have, again, pretty straightforward, blisters, acroblisters, with mottled pigmentation, hyperpigmentation on the trunk. It's very rare with a normal lifespan, but if that comes up on the exam, you should go for that. So Charlie, next is junctional EB.
Just real quick, Nick, I think because the audience can't really see us, but whenever you're talking about EBS with muscular dystrophy, I'm flexing my pecs because I've got big pectoralis muscles. And so whenever I think about EBS with muscular dystrophy, I think about big plecs and plectin being the key protein there. So anyway, moving on to junctional, I think you had mentioned.
I love that, Charlie. No one can see us, but I can see you and your pecs look great. So
thank you.
teach me some chest press after this. All right. I got to get
absolutely.
The pecs
it's all yoga.
Okay, good. Move on. Let's talk about junctional EB. Go ahead.
Yeah, junctional EB. So again, we're going to be like honing in on the basement membrane zone. We've moved really from the hemidesmosome, where keratin 5 and 14 kind of link into that hemidesmosome, and plectin and BPAG1 are up there. Now we've kind of moved down into the lamina lucida. So this is below the hemidesmosome at the basement membrane zone. Most of these, in fact, all of the main ones are autosomal recessive. This is definitely rare. And whenever you think about junctional EB, in general, the key thing to think about is these kids tend to have really robust oral, so aerodigestive manifestations. So they get enamel hypoplasia and pitting. So in the teeth, that's a pretty significant feature. And really, I think about three subtypes of junctional EB. You've got junctional EB generalized severe, junctional EB generalized intermediate, and then junctional EB with pyloric atresia. All of these have to do with the proteins that are extending across that lamina lucida. So with generalized severe, it's the genes are LAMA3, LAMB3, and LAMC2. So that's laminin 332. The big thing is that's the protein. The big thing with this is if you're going to look at this on an electron microscopy, you're going to see an absent hemidesmosome. I have absolutely seen a question on that where they showed electron microscopy, or they asked about an electron microscopy in a patient with blistering that showed absent hemidesmosome, or asked about an absent hemidesmosome, and that's junctional EB. These kids, they tend to have perioral robust granulation tissue. They have a hoarse cry because of the involvement of their larynx, and they can have some paronychial inflammation, so it can look like they have paronychia, and oral blisters are really common. And unfortunately, death is really common in these kids, really usually within the first years of life, and it happens from respiratory failure. So again, the aerodigestive system is really involved. The generalized intermediate, it's essentially the same thing, just as you know, generalized severe, just less severe. So you got laminin 332 is the major protein. The same genes are involved, with the exception it also can have collagen 17 or BPAG2 or BP180. These kids tend to get generalized severe. Again, it tends to be have significant oral involvement. A unique manifestation here is they tend to have some scarring alopecia. But again, the dental anomalies are pretty consistent. And these kids tend to survive to adulthood. They tend to be okay. And then the last form of junctional EB I think about is junctional EB with pyloric atresia. This one's unique because it has to deal with that alpha 6 beta 4 integrin. So obviously you have kind of the oral ulcerations, but in these kids you also have pyloric atresia. So that is the pylorus of the stomach, which is a sphincter. So then you can think about other sphincters being involved, like the ureter, so that you get ureteral stenosis. You can get rudimentary and malformed ears. And so that's junctional EB just in a nutshell, I think.
Right. The ear's not really a sphincter, but it's kind of a round tube. So maybe you can think about ears.
Nicholas, and the ears are clearly the sphincter of the face. So I would agree to disagree with you on that one.
Okay. Ears are the sphincter of the face, or people might be listening and say, where did this guy go to medical school?
I actually want that to be the quote of this episode. If you remember one thing from this episode, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to remember that the ears are the sphincter of the face.
So obviously during head and neck anatomy, I was totally asleep. That's obvious mm-hmm. here.
Exactly.
That was awesome. Charlie, let's finish off with dystrophic EB. So the level of the split here is now below the lamina densa of the BMZ. You're starting to get some scarring. We've got two major subtypes characterized by the mode of inheritance, dominant dystrophic and recessive dystrophic. And in general, dominant, which sounds worse, is actually a little bit more mild than recessive. You think dominant, stronger, bigger, but it's a little more mild. There's some overlap between these two. But let me just hear about from you, dominant and recessive, couple of key points on that.
Yeah. So, dominant is inherited in autosomal dominant fashion. All of these, whenever you think about dystrophic epidermolysis bullosa, there's one gene to know. It's collagen 7A1. There you have different mutations within there, which differentiates between them. So dominant dystrophic tends to be collagen 7A1 that has a missense mutation versus recessive dystrophic, which is a premature termination codon. That comes into play whenever we talk about therapeutics, and Lord willing, we'll have some better possible therapeutics down the line. But so in terms of, you know, dystrophic, there's really two major types of dystrophic EB. I think that we're moving away from these kind of eponymous or eponyms, but you got the Cockayne terrain and the Pacini subtype. The Cockayne terrain is really mostly you think about it as being these bulla really over extensor joints. They have these this like atrophic scarring and milia. It tends to get better over time versus Pacini. So you can think about Cocaine Terrain is like joints, and then Pacini is trunk. So Pacini tends to have these albopapulloid papules. I think about sometimes like with Dago's disease, I think about those codas as looking relatively similar, but albopapulloid papules that favor the trunk and they come spontaneously. Both forms of these dominant dystrophic have nail dystrophy. That's very important. And interestingly, the disease activity tends to get better over time, which is unique. So that's what I think about with dystrophic EB. Nick, why don't you tell me a little bit about dominant dystrophic? Why don't you tell me about recessive dystrophic?
Right. Yeah, I'd love to speak on this. This is probably one of the most important forms of EB that we're going to discuss, just because it has a lot of morbidity associated with it. And we may not see it a lot in clinic. It's definitely super popular, super fair game on the board. So recessive is generalized severe, sometimes known as the Hallopoe-Simmons type. It's autosomal recessive, obviously. And you have a mutation in collagen 7, but it's a premature termination codon leading to complete lack of anchoring fibrils, which is why the morphology is way worse. It's seen at birth. They get generalized mucocutaneous blisters. This heals with atrophic scarring and milia, and you're going to see very, very severe morbidity, such as pseudosyndactyly. They have what's called mitten deformities of their hands and feet, pretty pathognomonic. They have contractures of the digits and limbs, scarring alopecia, corneal erosions, oral blisters, microstomia, dental caries. They get strictures and GI complications, growth failure, anemia, dilated cardiomyopathy, and the two big ones here are renal failure and aggressive squamous cell carcinoma. And the squamous cell carcinoma is so severe, so aggressive, most of these patients die by age of 35. Also, if they ask you on the exam, what's another very common cause of morbidity, mortality? The second most common, perhaps, is going to be renal failure, about 12% mortality. So a super high yield for the board. May not be seeing it every day in clinic, but Charlie, that was such an awesome review. Everyone who's listening should get every question right on their core on the boards, and if they don't, then you didn't listen to this episode. You were studying
exactly.
Something else.
Rewind and listen again.
Yeah. Yes. If you listen, you should get every question right. So thank you so much. I learned a lot. Our resident colleagues learned a lot. Our early career derms probably learned a lot. I forgot about this stuff. They studied the ones for the boards and it slipped out of their mind. So Charlie, thank you so much for that. So let's jump into the episode. Camp Discovery. My first question for you, Charlie, is what is Camp Discovery?
Yeah. So Camp Discovery, first, I actually think that this is a perfect and beautiful segue to talk about Camp Discovery, because we just talked about a set of conditions that you don't commonly see in clinic, correct? I mean, this is something that we tend to, I think, focus on as residents, as boards fodder, because we're not really going to see it that much. If we do, we see it onesies, twosies. I can tell you that I have seen virtually all of these conditions, and most of them I have seen because I've attended Camp Discovery. And so I think that that's just a little plug and kind of talks about the value. One of my mentors from Wake Forest, her name's Kara Haberman, she produced a paper back several years ago, 2015, I think it was published, and it surveyed residents and asked them to really rate the educational experience whenever they volunteer at camp, at a medical camp, compared to learning it from a textbook or even learning it in clinic. And it asked about like a whole host of different conditions, and the residents that attended camp, they consistently said that learning conditions in a camp setting resulted in better memory retention of these conditions, a better learning environment, and more in-depth understanding of a particular condition than learning it in the clinic or in a textbook. So that's kind of like a perfect segue to Camp Discovery. So Camp Discovery, what is it? It's a one-week summer camp experience for kids with chronic skin conditions that was started and continues to be supported by the AAD, but it was started in 1993. And so it's been around 30 years. It started actually out in Minnesota, but since that time, it's expanded to include 5 camp centers across the country. It's a really unique and valuable experience for kids who participate. They get a chance to have a safe, empowering, and in many ways, life-altering experience. And I think that those values really expand to volunteers as well. And so that's what Camp Discovery is in a nutshell.
Awesome. I love that. I love that paper that you mentioned. That's super cool. And you're right. The best way to learn dermatology is to see it in person, right? And at these camps, it's a bunch of kids, a lot of them with rare diseases coming in. So while you're volunteering your time and helping them, they're helping you learn to become a better dermatologist. I love that. So my next question is, who's eligible for Camp Discovery? What kind of diseases? Is it common things like bad psoriasis, bad vitiligo, or do they have to have a rare disease like an EB or like a rare ichthyosis to attend?
The answer is yes, or let's see, E, all of the above. So okay. Camp Discovery accepts children.
I always love when it's all the above on the exam.
Exactly.
It's an easy way to answer.
Exactly.
You're like,
exactly.
That's right. All right. Okay.
So that's the correct answer in this situation. Right. Camp Discovery accepts children with all types of chronic skin conditions, from alopecia to atopic dermatitis to ichthyosis, epidermolysis bullosa, giant congenital melanistic nevi, vitiligo. Some are really common, like you mentioned, psoriasis, vitiligo, where we've got prevalence estimates of, 500,000, 600,000 kids in the United States per year, to things like epidermolysis bullosa, where we have less than 4,000 kids diagnosed per year. So any kid with a chronic skin condition is eligible. The ages that we're talking about at this point is really ages 8 to 16 years old. And that's typically the camp range. In Minnesota, they actually have 2 weeks. They divide it up into ages 8 to 13 and ages 4 to 16. But it's any condition, and those are the age group that's chronic skin condition, and it's those age ranges.
Awesome. So if your patient comes into your clinic with, bad psoriasis, bad vitiligo, bad alopecia, they're certainly eligible.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Okay. All right. And I kind of want to know what goes on there. I've got to make a plug for myself. I was the summer camp free throw champion back in fifth grade. So that was one of my great accomplishments in my life. And, I went to a sports camp. We did all sorts of sports. It was really fun. But what happens at Camp Discovery? Can you take me through a typical day there?
Absolutely. And I think it's so funny that you say that because what was like a sports summer camp? Is that what you did, Nick?
Exactly. Sports summer camp. Yep.
Yeah. So, but you have these formative experiences, right? In this summer camp where that you remember it. I mean, you're still only like 21 years old, but that's a formative memory from like 5 or 6 years ago, right? That you had. And so I think that, the answer is that really, in camp, the idea or the ideal is just to kind of have the traditional standard summer camp experience, right? So like basically what they do whenever I think about summer camp. So I went to summer camp as I was growing up and I remember fishing and swimming and archery and horseback riding and nature trails and talent shows and campfires and all of that I just described happens at Camp Discovery. So the truth is it provides a really safe, wonderful, traditional camp experience. So while, like I mentioned, there's 5 camp centers across the country, while they're all a little bit different in kind of what they provide, in terms of kind of the nuances, at their core, what they're trying to do. So for some of these kids, their day-to-day lives are dominated by being told what they can't do because of their skin condition. They're told what they, cannot do because it might result in X, Y, or Z. The emphasis of this time, of this week, is to break away some of those barriers and celebrate what they can do. So every day, while it's a little bit different, is just filled with activities that are geared towards promoting confidence, camaraderie, opportunities to open up, meet people with the same condition that they have, to grow together and individually, all in really this safe and protective environment. So that's really what a typical day or the typical camp experience is.
That's amazing. So inspiring. So Charlie, what kind of volunteers work at the camp? Who staffs the camp? It seems like a lot of work, right?
Yeah, it totally is, which is why we need you and why we want volunteers. So in general, I think about that. So there's 3 types of volunteers at camp. And so the first is the medical staff. Usually this consists of, board certified dermatologists, nurses, clinicians who have a degree of experience in treating and managing kind of the wide array of medical conditions that are seen at camp. As a resident or as a medical student, you could be put into this group, but more than likely, you'll actually fall into the second group, which is cabin counselors. So cabin counselors are people you kind of get paired up with a group of kids. So these volunteers, they actually have like a wide array of backgrounds. Some are college students, some are medical students, some are residents that are interested in dermatology, some actually, my personal favorite group within these cabin counselors are actually adults who were campers before or who have chronic skin conditions that they've had since they were kids. It's so cool seeing interactions between, you know, these counselors and these kids and seeing and talking with these people and seeing what their life has been like growing up from being kids to adults and kind of navigating their condition. So this group is usually paired off with, you know, a group of kiddos that you take care of, get to know, guide throughout the week. And then the third group is, these are employed by the individual camp location that you're at. So I did this whenever I was a little bit younger, my brother and I, at Camp Boggy Creek here in Florida. So these are young, usually they're college students. They work the camp the entire summer. So they work week to week and they really help to run all the amazing activities that make camp magical. So I say all that. So those are the three main volunteers. The truth is that what do you need to know and what do you need to do? I remember being really stressed about this as a medical student coming into camp. All you need to do is pour your heart and energy and mind into interacting with and enjoying the connections with kids. You don't have to worry about the medical side. We've got staff for that. You don't have to worry about providing activities and being the cool kid and knowing all the songs or anything like that. You just have to be present and be engaged. And that's kind of you know, where your role is.
Yeah, you're selling me so much on this. I'd love to volunteer, and I'm sure
you need to.
A lot of our colleagues wanted to. So just take me through the process. Let's say I'm in clinic. Let's say a patient comes in, 9-year-old female with widespread vitiligo affecting her face, affecting her hands. You think she'd be perfect for Camp Discovery. Take me through the process of how we can get her into the camp and her family as well, right? Because she's a young kid, so she can't go on her own probably, right?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So great, Nick, you're asking perfect questions. And I think this is important. So for you budding medical students out there and residents who are really interested in kind of formulating a quality improvement initiative, I truly think this is an opportunity for you. So the truth is that Camp Discovery has been blessed with an abundance of riches in terms of the support that it receives from volunteers. But we need campers. We want campers. And I think that there is an opportunity here for medical students and residents to figure out how you and your local community can refer kids to Camp Discovery, get them plugged into Camp Discovery. So let's talk a little bit about the logistics, because I'm glad you asked that. One of the most amazing things about this camp is that it is entirely free. Entirely free.
Wow,
and because of generous donations,
oh God,
exactly. Because of generous donations by the AAD, these camps, including travel, are entirely free for families. And it's not hard for a child to get accepted. Once you recognize this patient that you mentioned, Nick, with widespread vitiligo, they need three things. So they need a referral form that's readily available on the AAD website. This referral form needs to be filled out by a dermatologist, and it needs to be signed by a parent or guardian and submitted to Miss Janine Mueller with the AAD. And I'm happy to provide. I spoke with her just before this. More than happy to for you know us to get out the information and get her email out there so that you can do that. The truth is that despite this, kind of like I mentioned, it's free, it's easy access. The last several years, there have been unfilled spots. And so, you know, there's many reasons for that. I think we've got COVID. There actually are currently still spots available. So I don't know when this episode is airing, but the deadline to refer a patient is May 17th. So, you know, clinicians, if you're hearing this, think about patients in your clinic that you think could benefit from it and follow that process. The AAD has a really clear-cut process on their website that you can follow. And just to kind of reiterate, I just spoke with Ms. Mueller and she said that they anticipate having space for all those who are referred. And I want to challenge her on that. I want to force her to say yes to an incredible amount of people. So please refer people. Please refer kids. I think this is life-changing for kids.
Awesome. I hope that if this episode leads to at least one child being referred, then we've done a great job here today.
Amen.
So I think that's the case. I will put information for Ms. Mueller in the show notes and the link to the form. So we'll make it super easy for you, super easy for me, so we can get kids referred. So Charlie, this has been awesome. So tell me about what's your personal experience been at Camp Discovery?
So my experience for kids for camp. So I thought, Nick, for the longest time that I was going to be a camp doctor. That was like what that was what I thought I was going to be in medical school. So I thought experience with camps for kids with chronic medical conditions. It goes back as far as, you know, pre-medical school at Wake Forest. I spent a lot of time at Camp Victory Junction, which if you're at Wake Forest, you should definitely get involved in. It's incredible. This is a camp for kids that, you know, with multiple, you know, medical conditions from cancer to type 1 diabetes, Down syndrome, chronic skin conditions. I was at Camp Periwinkle as a pediatric resident, which is a camp for kids with cancer in Texas. I volunteered with Camp Discovery as a first-year resident, and I was blown away, even after experiencing all these different medical camps, with, one, the quality of the educational experience there. I learned so much as a first-year dermatology resident and as a board-certified pediatrician. I was like, yeah, I'm not going to learn anything here. Well, I was wrong. I think I was impressed by the educational experience. I was impressed by the depth of the relationships that were, that, you know, that I ignited there. Shout out to Dr. Sam. She's my girl. I got a chance to meet her. She is a wonderful, inspiring dermatologist who we still stay in contact today. You know, it created, you know, long-lasting relationships with people I consider to be mentors and friends. It plugged me into the AAD. So I got plugged into the AAD because of Camp Discovery, and it's led to multiple opportunities to get really deeply involved in the specialty and in the American Academy of Dermatology. And so it's really connected me with our field. And so my experience is that my life and my career trajectory and my personal, life experience has been significantly altered because of volunteering with Camp Discovery. A single week, that's all it took.
Such a special opportunity. The kids get to go to camp, have so much fun, get to do things they never would do before or be embarrassed to do. And then the providers and the camp counselors get great networking opportunities to meet other doctors. So such a great opportunity. I encourage all residents to take a week during their residency instead of vacation to volunteer. You're going to probably be tired. It's going to probably be a long week. But I think the Academy or the Camp Discovery will even cover your airfare and lodging while you're there. It's not a vacation. You'll be working, but at least they'll help you get there, right?
That's exactly right. And you get to eat camp food, which will constipate you for weeks, which is that much better.
Okay. And we need Dr. Charlie Dunn, camp doctor, on like Netflix. I mean, if that episode or that show came out, I would be watching that from day one. So if anybody listening is in TV production or film production, call us up. But we'll get Dr. Charlie Dunn, camp doctor, season one on Netflix coming in 2025.
There it is. It'll get canceled immediately.
At least hopefully one episode will be made.
One episode. That's all we need.
Yeah. So, Charlie, we're about out of time. Thank you so much for the information here. This is such an inspiring thing to do, place to work. It sounds like it's great benefit for the kids, great benefit for the providers, for the counselors. I encourage everyone to keep an eye out for your patients to get them referred and consider volunteering yourself. We're almost out of time again, Charlie, but one more quick question. I know you were a board-certified pediatrician in Alaska. So tell me, what was the most interesting thing or coolest thing about working in Alaska?
Oh, so many. You know, whenever I told my mom that I was going to Alaska, she cried, not for joy. And I said, you know, why are you crying, Mom? It's you know, it's gonna be okay. She said she didn't think that I had what it took to live in an igloo. So first of all, Mom,
neither
how
do
dare
I,
you?
For the record, neither do
question.
I.
Second of all, Mom, you were right that I couldn't live in an igloo. And third of all, that's not at all what Alaska's like. Alaska's beautiful. It's incredible. Shout out to my peeps in the last frontier. Treating AKs, if in dermatology out there, it's very easy. You just stick your involved skin in the snowbank for 3 minutes. Don't actually do that. I hope I didn't just create a lot of frostbite. Everyone should visit. Learn to fish, learn how to handle a moose charging you, or how to operate bear spray without spraying yourself or your child in the face, which we're not going to go into that story, but it was awesome, Nick. Everyone podcast. Should visit. It's a beautiful place, and honestly, nothing but fond memories about it.
Awesome. Yeah, while we're talking now, I'm getting on United and booking my next vacation
there
to
you go.
Alaska. It sounds
there
so cool. Definitely a bucket list place for me. So cool you got to live there. Charlie, thank you again. Such an awesome episode. So much great information. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, Nick. This has been great.